Welcome, everybody, to the August 2016 CCL International Conference Call. This is Joe Robertson, CCL's Global Strategy Director, filling in for Mark Reynolds. Mark is celebrating his 35th wedding anniversary, so he was not able to be here today. This month, we're honored to have two leaders from the Truman National Security Project, Keir Ramsey and Justin Ford, joining us. I'm going to tell you a little bit about them and then turn it over to them to tell us about what they do. Keir Ramsey is a policy program manager at the Truman National Security Project and Truman Center. She leads programming on energy and climate security in Latin America. She previously served as Truman Project liaison on Capitol Hill and coordinated Congressional Security Scholars programming. Rikia served on Capitol Hill as the military legislative correspondent for U.S. Senator Kay Hagan, and before that as constituent service representative in the Greensboro office for Senator Hagan, providing assistance to veterans and their families. Justin Ford is the organizing director of the Truman National Security Project. His responsibilities include building and maintaining a national leadership structure, overseeing advocacy and organizing tactics, leading a comprehensive training and professional development program for Truman members and allied organizations. He founded the Defense Council, during which time he also served as president of VetPAC. Justin led the development and launch of Dog Tag Bakery, a startup nonprofit business for veterans with disabilities, and Justin served in the U.S. Army as an airborne combat engineer. Thank you for joining us, Justin. I'm going to turn it over to you to tell us a little bit about what the Truman Project and Operation Free are focused on and what kind of resources you make available that might benefit our volunteers in their efforts.
Sure. Thank you so much for having us. It's a real honor. Tell you a little bit about us and who we are. Our main objective is we are a coalition of veterans and national security experts who believe oil dependence and climate change pose a national security threat, and we advocate for securing America with clean energy across the board. And we do that through a few different ways. We recruit military leaders. These are people that served in various capacities. Some of them were generals, some of them were admirals. Some of them served in more of a logistic role within the military. And we also recruit, train, and use people that have national security expertise with also an energy role that happen to be civilians in our advocacy efforts. We do this by going through a few different advocacy tactics. One of the biggest things we do is legislative briefings. We've had an enormous amount of success getting both Republicans and Democrats in the room. And I think one of the things that makes us stand out in one of our strong suits is the fact that we bring military leaders, Pentagon leaders, things of that nature, into the room, and that appeals not only to Democrats, but it also appeals to Republicans. We speak from the operational side of things quite often. We try to take politics out of it, and we talk about the national security threats that are a single source of energy dependency, aka fossil fuels, poses for our nation, along with climate change. And people tend to be a little more receptive to that message versus if we are going in there solely speaking about, you know, why clean energy is good for, you know, the moral or value-based arguments. Ours is almost solely focused on operational and the national security threats it poses. And by that, just to give you a few quick examples, and then we'll go into more detail when we're answering questions. We talk a lot about policies that support reducing America's dependency on oil. We believe that a single source of dependency, especially in our transportation sector, poses a real national security threat, and we talk about the reasons why. And I think that's something that they understand. We also talk a lot about policies that support the military's investment in clean energy technology. Our military is doing a lot of wonderful things, in the clean energy space that a lot of people that may be on this call would be really interested in. They see it as not only the right thing to do, but the smart thing to do. We now have large sections of our Navy that operate in our Air Force that operate on biofuels and other renewable energy sources. Our bases are now using solar in a big way. If you visited the Pentagon recently, you would notice the solar panels in the parking lot. We also use renewable energy downrange. And by downrange, I mean while deployed in a hostile or combat zone. Things like keeping our generators going, recharging our batteries, things that make a lot of operational sense. And clean energy plays a big part in that. And not only that, most of the countries that, I don't want to say that are enemies, but are people that don't necessarily have America's best interest in mind, are very much funded by oil. And as everyone knows, oil is a global commodity. So we're trying to break our addiction to oil and also break the cycle of giving money to people that don't necessarily like us. We also talk about climate change. Climate change is one of the interesting issues that a large portion of the American public, unfortunately, doesn't believe is true. But our military, again, is not, they don't base their policy on politics. They base their policies on science. And the Pentagon and various related Department of Defense agencies have repeatedly stated that climate change is not only real, but it's a national security threat. And we carry on that message. And if you go to our website, which is called OperationFree.com, you'll be able to find a lot of the information that I just spoke about in more detail. And we'd also be happy to answer any questions in further detail that you may currently have. So with that, I'll go ahead and turn it back over.
Thank you, Justin. That was great. It was very quick and detailed, and I think we have a great sense of why Operation Free is an important part of the conversation about climate change and national security. There are a lot of angles that our volunteers approach these questions from, and sometimes that has to do with the way the people in office are thinking about it or the questions that they're looking to answer. I wanted to put a couple of questions to Rekia to build on what Justin has just said. Rekia, what do you see as the most significant threat posed by climate change to our national security?
Hi, Joe. Yes, thank you. And Justin, thank you for giving that great overview. And to answer the question, is the most significant threat, I think it's just to reiterate a little bit of what Justin is saying. What we think the most significant threat for climate change would be our fragile states and basically communities that are not prepared to deal with the effects of climate change. And so just putting this in the context of the military is often the one who has to either answer the call or help those that are or have been affected by fragile states, whether it's a hurricane or a massive flood. And as we know, climate change is contributing to increasingly frequent severe weather events and resource scarcity, which can be threat multipliers for today's conflicts and exacerbate those of the future. So fragile cities, those with limited infrastructure and governance systems that cannot meet the health, security, or economic needs of its residents can threaten American security, namely because when the government cannot respond to the needs of its citizens, what happens is, or what we have seen, is that organizations, sometimes terrorist groups, come in and aid these communities and treat these areas then as breeding grounds for recruitment. or food background. And so communities that are originally divided or traumatized by violence or lack of access to key resources or even marginalized minorities and the poor are more susceptible to conflict, disease, and, you know, hunger and other effects that come with natural disasters. So that is how we see it. That is honestly how the military sees it as well. And as Justin was saying, there are a lot of times, you know, oil is a global commodity. And so as we, no matter if we are buying oil drilling here at home or importing this resource, it will end up into the hands of those that are not, would share our same values. And then the added, irony there is that the military then is called upon to answer these threats. And so they are seeing it on both ends. Not only do they use this resource in through its own, you know, trucks, planes, tanks, and everything that it has, which is why, as Justin said, it is looking for ways to diversify and ways to use renewable sources. It's then on the thorny end of our energy policy when they have to, you know, go into conflict zones or, answer the call of warfare.
I think that's really important information. I mean, we hear a lot of times that the U.S. government somehow has the luxury of choosing between intervening or not intervening, between caring about what happens overseas or not. And you're saying that from a military standpoint, from a national security standpoint, fragile states are not something we can just take lightly. They become a breeding ground for increased hostility. They become the places where civil wars break out and cross-border wars break out, and then the military has to often respond. And so just to bring back something that you mentioned and that Justin also said, you know, one of the questions from some of our volunteers has been, do you see connections between the way that our whole economy interacts with energy and our national security outlook? Does the work of Operation Free or the Truman Center touch on the ways that local governments can think about supporting a more secure future by building low-emissions communities? Is this something that actually helps us build our national security?
Yes. As you mentioned, and we're just saying here, right, the global production of fossil fuels is a driver of instability or conflict. You know, some of the largest oil producers are weak or failing states, and they are competing for control over resources, which potentially leads to interstate conflict. And we're starting to see some of these bubble up in the South China Sea, between China and the Philippines. Guaranteeing our security in the 21st century will require new thinking about the ways we use energy at home, as well as the manner in which we arm, mobilize, or fuel our forces. So there are direct connections we see between our whole economy. I think it's 93 or over 90% of our transportation runs on oil. So companies that are trying to ship goods within our boundaries, folks that are traveling just back and forth for, you know, whether that's work or just leisure, they're not able to do that without getting in a vehicle, for the most part, that's not going to use oil. And so we need to be thinking about how to diversify our portfolio. On the policy side here, we advocate for, you know, policies that allow for standards for light-duty vehicles and heavy-duty vehicles. We see that's a way of ramping down. Anywhere that there are, at the local level, where there's policies for changing of infrastructure or allowing for more electric vehicle plug-ins, things of that. We just need to be thinking about how we are going to start ramping down. We're realistic in thinking that not something that we can just do tomorrow because it's so interconnected. But, you know, investments in research and development and investments in infrastructure, especially our critical infrastructure, is something that we advocate for. And you know, we definitely see connections there between our economy and our gay national security.
That's great. Rekia, just one quick follow-up. Are you saying that this single source dependency that both you and Justin have mentioned, that makes it more likely we get sucked into the kind of conflict that's arising over South China Sea oil, for instance?
For instance, right. That's right. And again, like we could drill more here at home, but it's just not realistic. We don't have enough in our own resources for one. But two, you know, greenhouse gas emissions is something else we need to be thinking about. And so less emissions and more renewable sources is definitely makes us more secure and contributes to having a more secure nation.
That's great. Okay, that's really good information, I think. I want to go back to Justin for a minute. Justin, you know, we often hear from those who are skeptical about climate action that they think it's going to cost too much. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the hidden costs that the military deals with in its operations, and how do these costs make it harder for us to establish sustainable national security?
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. Ian, just before I answer that question, I was receiving a large echo during the first half of my speech, so if I wasn't clear on anything, I'd also be happy to come back to that. But there's a lot of hidden costs, and that's one of the things we talk about when we're either on a panel, we're doing a legislative briefing, we're doing something of this nature. And one of the reasons that we recruit people that have kind of operational experience, that have kind of been on the ground and see the results of our current energy infrastructure. And just to give you one clear example, I believe that this study was done in 2009, and we've talked about this a lot in the past. One in every 24 convoys, fuel convoys, was actually subject to an attack in 2009 in Afghanistan. And if you think about that, you think about how many fuel convoys it takes to operate throughout the country of Afghanistan, that's an enormous casualty rate, people that were either killed or injured because of our needs to supply energy, especially oil, to the front lines. There are thousands of convoys that are needed, every month throughout our operations in both Afghanistan and Iraq. And not only are they attacked, but they're easier target. So I was part of the initial invasion of Iraq in 2004, or 2003, into 2004. And any time a fuel convoy is hit by an IED, by a rocket, or anything of that nature, not only is it probably going to kill the individual that's driving that vehicle, but as you can imagine, when a tanker is hit, that explosion is compounded and often results in more casualties because of the fuel inside than would normally happen when any other vehicle was hit. And I also just want to point out the fact that our current military vehicles don't necessarily get the best gas mileage. So you may be driving a tank that gets 7 or 8 miles per gallon. So just put that in perspective and think about how much oil we need just to operate on a daily basis, even outside of combat, just to have a presence or a force on the ground. And it's fairly enormous. And it takes a lot of people to guard those convoys. It's a large part of our operation and costs an enormous amount. And the last point I'll make, I think this is really relevant. The transportation of fuel is enormous. So that's one of the things that legislatures or people in general generally don't take into account, is how much money it actually costs to transport oil into a country like Afghanistan or Iraq. And that's another hidden cost.
Wow. So even before we get to climate change itself, just the dependency on oil creates a number of different compounded costs. The cost of the fuel itself, the dependency, the transportation of this heavy material, the explosiveness of that material, and then it's a risk to the lives of service personnel as well.
Yeah, and just to visualize it for you, you know, if you were to launch a rocket into a solar panel versus a fuel tanker, I mean, there's quite the difference. So there's a lot of compounded risk there.
Wow. I think that's something that we can all, to me, in conversations with people that I know who've served, I have family members who've served, I think of the desire to reduce that risk, that their personal well-being, to be a very important part of this conversation. Is that also part of the focus of what you are working on?
Yeah, it very much is. And not only is the military's number one focus to make the lives of our servicemen and women safer during their operations and their service, but it's very much the almost sole focus of the men and women on the ground. So anything we can do to create a safer environment and also without, and I think this is key too, we can do these things without making us less effective. So if you have a vehicle that can go three or four times as far without additional fuel, you are more combat effective than a vehicle that can go a third of that, that needs that extra oil supply that provides a greater risk for our service members.
Wonderful. I think that's also a very important detail. This isn't a cost. This is an improvement. Another question for you, Justin. Some of our volunteers have this experience where one of the members of Congress they interact with is a former Air Force pilot and is on several committees related to defense and emerging threats. But this particular member of Congress doesn't really feel climate change is a significant national security issue. Do you have any ideas for our volunteers about how to talk to such a person to help them see the national defense case for climate change in a way that they may find compelling given the other things they're focusing on?
Sure. And I think this is a common challenge. And one of the things that I think our campaign Operation 3 was built to hopefully tackle. Again, I think it goes back to what I was saying in the speech earlier, is we try our best to take politics out of the conversation. And sometimes it's difficult to do that. So when speaking with someone that clearly doesn't believe in climate change or whatever the case may be, the harm that's currently being done to the environment, we simply talk on a tactical scale. So I would encourage that individual to literally just Google Department of Defense reports, clean energy, climate change, and there's a lot of information that's come out. The Pentagon has put out various studies. The Secretary of the Navy, Secretary Mavis, has done an enormous amount of work on renewable energy, climate change, and talks about it on a frequent basis. So there's a lot of material out there that can back the argument without ever getting into politics.
That's great. And that also goes right back to some of the things you were just saying about the tactical and operational implications of fuel switching. Rakia, I wanted to give you another question related to the work of our volunteers, which is that we focus on a carbon fee and dividend policy at Citizens Climate Lobby, and we have strong support from economists and retired military leaders. for this particular approach to decarbonization. How would you describe the value of putting a price on carbon for strengthening our national security now and into the future?
Sure, Joe. The value, I think, to me, I would say, I have to say this first, we are an organization that represents its members, and so we have positions that we have come out on publicly, and some we have not, only because that is not something that our membership has come to consensus on. One example would be nuclear energy and maybe natural gas. But something like a carbon tax, I think that the 30,000 foot is something that is a mechanism to get us to perhaps more investment starting perhaps maybe turn the ship towards newer and cleaner renewable sources. I think we need to be mindful that, oil and coal, for that matter, did get us to where we are. It is one of the reasons why we are such an economic powerhouse, we need to think about the communities that would suffer as a result of lost jobs, coal miners and things of that nature. So, I think our value would harken back to, the lives of our service members the preservation of our planet just trying to mitigate climate change and the effects of climate change wherever we're at. We've talked about the threats posed to fragile states, but just in our own communities, we are starting to see more and more floods. Just yesterday and this morning, we're dealing with floods down in Louisiana. These are historical floods that they are seeing. We saw what the devastation to Hurricane Sandy did to us, and we are not prepared for it, at least in the way that we should be or can be. Domestic policies, for instance, we do support the Clean Power Plan, and the direction we feel that it will take us. Like I stated before, we support standards on, transportation vehicles, light-duty vehicles, heavy-duty vehicles, for example. And so a carbon tax, specifically, is not something we publicly talk about. If it is combined with sort of research and investment in the community, bringing back jobs or green jobs to the community, then that is something that I think we would support. But more to your question was what value. And at least from our standpoint and the national security standpoint, we would talk very much about the value of, keeping men and women out of harm's way, not having to get them involved into conflicts just to protect this resource, thinking about the military as a leader, the innovations that have come out of the military, the internet, GPS, and, what they're doing, some of the amazing things that they're doing with renewable energy for the sake of national security and for the sake of saving lives is something that has the potential to spill over into the civilian world. And we're really excited about that. And so I don't think I can overstate the value when it comes to saving lives or our environment and our national security. I hope that answers that question.
Yeah, I think it does. I just want to ask you if you think this is a good way to sum up what you said, which to me it sounds like you want to make sure that the membership are represented, and so certain policies are your focus. With something like carbon pricing, you take a bird's eye view, and you look down at the landscape and you say, we need to transition to other kinds of fuels simply because the status quo is creating these security risks. but we need to have an integrated approach to this. We need to think about whether people at home are more secure or not, whether our military is more secure or not, and collectively whether we're creating more secure circumstances. And a policy like that, if it's done right, could create a more efficient approach to investment in that transition.
That's exactly right, Joe. Thank you. That's exactly right. And to get some more of our messaging, I just want to say again the website, like Justin mentioned in the beginning, operationfree.net, www.operationfree.net. And there's some other really good talking points up there, but yes, I couldn't have said it better myself, Joe. Thank you.
Absolutely. Well, thank you both. And I just want to make sure that everybody listening knows that the website for Operation Free is in the action sheet for this month, so you can find it right there and go and learn more about what Justin and Rakia have been talking about. Thank you both so much. I think this has been really informative, and you're welcome to stay on and listen for the rest of the call if you'd like to. We're going to do some reports from the field to hear what some of our volunteers have been up to. I want to focus on Northern California. We've had volunteers who have patiently, diligently been working to persuade the California Medical Association to pass a resolution calling for climate action. And on July 29th, the Board of Trustees of the California Medical Association, CMA, approved the following recommendations from the Council on Science and Public Health. Among a number of other things relating to climate, the California Medical Association recognizes that climate change threatens the health and well-being of the patients served by California's physicians and supports efforts to communicate with our local, state, and national legislators about the need to take action to adapt to and mitigate the effects of climate change. So recognizing the health impacts and calling for action from legislators. It's a huge endorsement, and it's a great example of citizen volunteers listening to the concerns of an organization that's going to take its time, that's going to be diligent about the facts, and is going to work to get support from membership and building over time the momentum to get a resolution passed. It's great work, and the volunteers from Northern California, including Don Gade, who worked on that, should be very proud. We have a couple other reports, but I want to mention briefly this one interesting example of citizen leadership from Panama. Our team of volunteers in Panama has been meeting with the Energy Ministry, the Environment Ministry, talking to the government about how Panama can strengthen its national climate action strategy, which is still in development, by putting a price on carbon. And now the government of Panama, after a number of these conversations, has requested that the Carbon Pricing Leadership Coalition, of which Citizen Climate Lobby is a part, set aside some time for a group of partners to work on carbon tax policy design to make sure that governments that want to go in that direction have the best kind of analysis that they can get and that they can have help in designing the best policy approach. So that's great work by CCL Panama. And I want to focus now on our emerging groups in Africa. Now, as Global Strategy Director, I get to work with volunteers on five continents outside of North America. And our groups in Africa have just been growing incredibly quickly this year. On January 1st, we had no active local groups in Africa. Now we have active groups in Abuja, Nigeria, Kampala, Uganda, Nairobi, Kenya, Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, Bamenda, Cameroon, Banjul in the Gambia, Kumasi, Ghana, Abidjan in Côte d'Ivoire, our first French language local group in Africa, and Kano, Nigeria is the newest one. And we have another group that's getting ready to start up in Côte d'Ivoire, also French-speaking, as well as new groups in development in Malawi, Madagascar, and Liberia. And each of the countries I mentioned already also have volunteers who are working to support others starting up local groups. Some of these local groups have been hosting town hall meetings where they bring lawmakers into contact with the community, and they've just been doing an excellent job building a new civic space that didn't exist before. One more piece of news. CCL Abuja in Nigeria has been hosting a weekly radio program on KISS FM to educate people across Nigeria and across the region about climate impacts and climate solutions. So those are a few reports from the field, just a couple examples of how CCL volunteers are doing great things. And I'm going to turn it over now to Madeline Parra to talk a little bit about this month's actions.
Thanks, Joe. Can you hear me?
Yes, we hear you. Go ahead.
Okay, great, great. You know, I was sitting here with my Madison group thinking about all the groups that are meeting today or later this week, and now I'm thinking about them all around the world. So thanks, Joe. That was fantastic. And, you guys are all working on how to move things forward in your community, and I just want you to know that you are a joy to work with. So we have two recommended actions this month for the U.S., and they're such big ones that we anticipate they'll be our actions next month as well. So first is to make plans to gather endorsements or other forms of community support, and that's based on what your research tells you will reach your members of Congress. And the second one is to get ready to attend town hall meetings, candidate forums, and campaign events. As you know, we don't endorse candidates, but by showing up well-dressed, appreciative, and with strategic questions and comments, we can start or continue a good relationship with these public figures. So we also encourage you to take a few minutes to practice the communication skills exercise on connecting with local environmental groups. That's the focus this month. And we need to be able to listen well to groups on both sides of the political spectrum. And just to give you a few extra minutes for that, we left off the laser talk this month so that you might have a little extra time for it. So then on to the Canadian actions. And first, I get to tell you that on July 15th, Canada's Minister for Environment and Climate Change, with the support of a huge business coalition, announced that Canada is going to have a national price on carbon by the end of the year. Thank you, Canada. So CCL Canada's next step is to make sure that the politicians who support carbon pricing know they have a well-organized, highly motivated, and national grassroots coalition behind them. So with that in mind, the Canadian actions are, first, to get 30 signatures on a paper version of the parliamentary petition for carbon fee and dividend and ask your MP to present it in the House of Commons when Parliament resumes in the fall. And second, it's housekeeping time. So Kathy Orlando wants you to make sure that your 2016 field reports are up to date so that we can report to the world in September all that we've been doing together in 2016. I have to say, that sounds like a good idea everywhere. So, and then I lastly just want to congratulate CCL Vancouver, British Columbia, which by the end of next week will have lobbied 6 members of Parliament face-to-face this summer. So way to go, Canada. And that's it, Joe. Thanks.
Great. Thank you, Madeline, so much. I just love hearing the diligence with which people are making sure that they're taking action together and the excitement that people put into actually having face-to-face meetings like that as a team. You know, in the work that I'm doing internationally, we're now starting up a process of shared region-wide monthly actions for the different regions that we work in outside of North America, and that was a great report that makes, I think, is going to give us a great idea of how people can translate what happens in one country into what can happen in another. Thank you also, Rikia and Justin, for your contribution. It's been really useful, I think, having this conversation and hearing about your work. Next month, our guest on the call is going to be Bob Inglis. He's going to talk to us about legislative process. This is part of our focus on the promise to pass our bill in 2017. We're getting down to nuts and bolts to think about what are the ins and outs, moment to moment, of how that gets done. And remember, though many different kinds of complications can slow progress on such a big task, this promise is a commitment to work constructively with everyone, to listen to people who differ from us, to think of people who oppose us as potential partners, and to follow through no matter who controls Congress, no matter who controls the White House. Under Article 6 of the United States Constitution, the commitment our nation made in Rio in 1992 to act to avoid catastrophic climate change is, quote, the supreme law of the land. It's a ratified treaty. Last Paris in December, for the first time, we brought all the nations of the world into the shared mandate to act against climate change. So it's no longer just the wealthy industrial countries. Everyone in the world is on our team now. So if you think about it in that light, and you remember what we're doing as CCL, we're going to work with everybody, we're going to listen, we're going to make partners out of people who used to oppose us. Following through on the promise is simply about citizens bringing our leaders together around a solution that works for everybody to defend our nation, to honor the constitutional system, and to pass on a livable future to the next generation. Thank you, everybody, for the work you're doing. Thank you for getting together and being part of this call. And as Madeline said, it's a joy to work with all of you, and we look forward to talking to you in the days and weeks to come. Thanks, everybody. Enjoy what's left of your summer.